Would you like us to introduce ourselves?
I would like that very much.
All right.
Because I know some of you, but not most of you.
Yeah. Okay. I'm Wendy, Ellie,
Nico.
Wait, Ron. Slow down. Nico.
Janine.
Hi, Janine.
Ron.
Jeffrey.
Steve.
Judy.
Karen.
And I'm Jill. And I'm very honored to be here, and can't possibly fill Angie's seat, but I'll do my best to talk with you a little bit. It's so interesting, first of all, just how we do things the same, and yet they're very different, you know, from Sangha to Sangha. And so when we chant the chant before the lecture, our pacing is so different from yours. Mm-hmm. And you know, who knows how that starts, that you say things at a certain speed, but it just is you know, it's wonderful to hear your voices together, and that's your Sangha voice, and it sounds particular and also very familiar. So it's good to be here. And speaking of being here, I've been thinking a lot lately about, I think about this on and off all the time. What am I doing here? How did I get here? it is curious. And maybe you all think that for yourself. You know, what brought you here? I think the standard answer, the answer that I didn't know right away, but the standard answer is suffering. Suffering brings us here. But maybe it also might be curiosity, or maybe it just might be you had a friend, or maybe I know one person who started meditating because her husband meditated, and by golly, she was going to be better at it than he was. So all kinds of reasons, right? But the reason, I think, behind the reason is maybe you know this word, bodhicitta. You know, the awakening mind, the desire to be awake. And we're taught often in Buddhism that desires, those aren't good things, we should get rid of them. I'm not a fan of that approach. I think that, you know, desire is something to practice with the same as anything else. But there are wholesome desires, and the desire to be awake, I think that's what keeps us here. It might not be what brought us to begin with, and yet I think somewhere deep down it was. So maybe one of the original expressions of bodhicitta was when the Buddha held up a flower. You know that story?
Yeah.
The Buddha held up the flower and Mahakasyapa smiled. He didn't say anything. He came to the assembly, and all he did was hold up a flower, and Mahakasyapa smiled. So what did Mahakasyapa see? What did the Buddha see? What was the smile, I imagine, that they exchanged? They saw the flower, of course, this moment, this flower, these lovely flowers, the colors. But they saw also the mind that perceives the flower, and the mind consciousness that together they raised up with the flower. And I think that's bodhicitta, this mind consciousness that we raise up. And it's this mind that needs to be guarded and also tamed, in order to see the flower in each moment and in each encounter as the flower is raised up. But you know, if you've meditated for longer than a moment or more, you know how wild the mind is, how difficult it is to contain it, Sometimes it blows away like the wind has been blowing the last few days. Sometimes it's rushing like a river. Sometimes it just gets stuck in the mud, like a boat in a very shallow water, and it just won't move. So I want to talk tonight about how it is we awaken the mind and how we continue to train it to know this mind of enlightenment, this bodhicitta. Because this is what sustains us in practice, it's what we deepen in practice. And then once we've awakened a little bit, we have to continue to work with the mind in order to continue with our practices of awareness and compassion. So perhaps you're familiar with Shantideva. I don't know if that's a new name or a familiar name, but Shantideva is kind of an expert on all of this business about bodhisattva practice. He wrote a book, he didn't write a book, he actually gave a talk, which became this book, The Way of the Bodhisattva. And I find his story in some ways very encouraging, because he was kind of a ne'er-do-well. It's said that when he was born, like the Buddha, there was this prediction that he would be a great king or great teacher, and he didn't want any of that, and he ran away. And this is sort of the mythology, I think, that Manjushri came and taught him personally the Dharma. But then he had to come back down to earth, and he went to university. And the university at the time was Nalanda in northern India. It was a great university from about the 5th to the 9th or 10th century. And actually there's some work going on in India right now to rebuild it. It's really a wonderful place. I was fortunate enough to be there and walk there and imagining the great teachers who had walked there, including Shantideva. So when Shantideva came to Nalanda, he was the kind of, maybe you knew a student like this in high school or college who never went to classes, never got any work done, never participated in the Sangha. They said that his dharmas, his three dharmas, were eating, sleeping, and shitting. And that's what he was good at. And I'm sorry to use such an earthy word, but that's exactly how I heard it in those words. That's right in the introduction. So, how kids like that in our class, they become the butt of jokes, and people make fun of them. And so they thought they would really, really embarrass him completely. And I think they wanted to get rid of him, you know. So they said, okay, Shantideva, we'd like you to preach the Dharma. And to their surprise, he agreed. And he came to the assembly, and lo and behold, he wasn't just sitting as I am. He wasn't just sitting among everyone. There was this huge, tall throne, and he was up there on this throne. And he asked, would you like me to tell you something new or something that you've heard before? And they said, well, we'd like to hear something new. So he came forth with this, what's called the Bodhicharya Vatara, the Way of the Bodhisattva, which is a very, very, very long poem. And he says at the beginning, I'm saying this to you, I'm teaching this to you, not really to teach you, but more because it encourages and helps me. And this is how I am trying to practice. And as I say, this book, this Way of the Bodhisattva, now it's a book, is about how to cultivate bodhicitta, how to deepen bodhicitta, how to practice compassion in the world. And so he says near the beginning, he says of the mind, he says, wandering where it will, the elephant of mind, will bring us down to pains of deepest hell. No worldly beast, however wild, could bring upon us such calamities. And as I say, you probably have experienced that. It's amazing how the mind can make us suffer greatly. We can remember something that we did maybe in third grade, and it comes back to us like it was yesterday, and we just still feel terrible about it. It's amazing what calamity. And it is wild, like an elephant. And if you imagine even a baby elephant running around this room, that would be a calamity. But that's what it is, what goes on in here. And so this is what's so important to him, is how to train this mind, how to calm it. So, as I say, this way of the Bodhisattva, it's a treatise on how to arouse bodhicitta, how to maintain it, and then how to deepen it even further. And so I want to talk about one chapter in particular. There's a lot, you know, that could be focused on. But what I have been interested in, I think because I have a wild elephant mind, is the taming of the mind. What the chapter is called vigilance, but I like taming of the mind. That's a little easier to... It's a little softer, I think, than vigilance. That kind of sounds like I have to get my army uniform on, and you know, but I think it's done a little more lightly. And this chapter is really, I understand that you've all been studying the precepts, yes? And this chapter is really about, it's sort of got three different parts, three different focuses, and they're basically the three pure precepts, which is what all of the precepts flow from. Just of the way it's said, I don't know, I think you do the meal chant, and I know it's in the meal chant, of avoiding all evil, doing all good, saving all beings. So, focusing on taming the mind, and in particular, this business of avoiding all evil. Each of these is important, but this is where it starts. And this is all of these. These are disciplines in the sense, these aren't just lofty ideas or ideals of doing all good and avoiding all evil. They're not just pretty words. They are, as I say, trainings. And I looked up the word discipline. I was kind of surprised because I make the distinction. So some of you know that I work with children and I work with families, and I make the distinction with parents between discipline and punishment, because I think they're very different. However, when I went to the dictionary, this took me by surprise because it said the practice of training people to obey rules or a code of behavior, that's okay, using punishment to correct disobedience. And so I have, maybe to suit myself, I have separated those. But I think in a way it fits for us in practice. I don't think we are... I think we do train, disciplines are ways of training ourselves, and what happens as a result of not paying attention to those rules of conduct, I think we see it, we don't have to be punished. I think that we see it arise for us as causes and conditions, that this happens and then that happens. Because we act this way, these things happen, our good old friend karma. So the training part, that resonates for me. I don't think we need to be punished in order to bring home the necessity of training. And Shantideva approaches this training idea in a way that is both strict and relaxed. He kind of goes back and forth between the two. And I think it's something we all have to learn for ourselves in practice. Sometimes we have to be very strict with ourselves, but sometimes we need to relax a little and let loose and enjoy ourselves. So just as an example of this, there's often this back and forth with the verses where he'll say one thing and then he'll say the next till he says, and I think he's talking about zazen here, and maybe these are the instructions you've been taught too, is to keep your eyes cast down and not look about, not be idly, you know, trying to figure out, even though you're, you know, what your neighbor is doing over there. He says, I shall never vacantly allow my gaze to wander all about, but rather with a focused mind will always go with eyes cast down. So that's pretty strict. But in the next verse he says, but that I might relax my gaze, I'll sometimes raise my eyes and look around. And if some person stands within my sight, I'll greet him with a friendly word of welcome. So we're not so strict and rigid with ourselves that we don't recognize that we're practicing with other people. You know, that would be unkind, and that would be a way of doing some harm. So it's both. It's both for him. So how do we do this thing of training ourselves to avoid evil? I was reading in Reb Anderson's book on the precepts. He talks about the three pure precepts. And he says this. He says, the root of all evil is misunderstanding the nature of self and other by actively ignoring the interdependence of self and other. Evil comes from turning away from the vivid world of creation, where the self can never remain separate from other beings. It's a denial of the ever-changing flux of sensory experience. Evil is turning away from life. The full realization of refraining from evil comes with waking up to the teaching of interdependence. Those are very lovely words, and I enjoy reading Reb because I think he really takes things very deeply. But there's nothing really practical there that I can wrap my mind around and know what to do. And so I think it's... I think our practice, what I find the most encouraging and most long-lasting for me are ways that actually I can put this into practice. It's what I once had a parent say to me when I was giving some lofty explanation of something. He said, well, how can I operationalize that? I hated that word. It's so mechanical. And yet what he was saying is, you know, come on, tell me what I can do. So how do we operationalize this dharma of refraining from evil? So Shantideva, as I say, gives some very practical advice, and I'm going to read it to you in a moment. And it's amazing to me, this is coming from someone in the 8th century in India living a monastic life, and I think that you will hear there are examples of the types of things that we encounter right here in 21st century, comfortable America. So his teaching is what's called remaining like a log. I don't know if you're familiar with that. But you know, a log just lays there. Doesn't get excited. Doesn't go rolling around on its own. Maybe it gathers a little moss. Maybe there's flowers growing by it. But it just stays still. So he says, when an urge arises in the mind to feelings of desire or wrathful hate, do not act, be silent, do not speak, and like a log of wood, be sure to stay. Has that ever happened to you, feelings of desire or wrathful hate?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When the mind is wild with mockery and filled with pride and haughty arrogance, and when you want to show the hidden faults of others, to bring up old dissensions, or to act deceitfully, and when you want to fish for praise, or criticize and spoil another's name, or use harsh language, sparring for a fight, it's then that, like a log, you should remain. And when you yearn for wealth, attention, fame, a circle of admirers serving you, and when you look for honors, recognition, you never do that. Right? It's then that, like a log, you should remain. And I like this. And when you want to do another down and cultivate advantage for yourself, and when the wish for gossip comes to you, it's then that, like a log, you should remain. Impatience, indolence, faint-heartedness, and likewise haughty speech and insolence, attachment to your side, when these arise, it's then that, like a log, you should remain. Well, we can't just get there overnight. And it's not an easy thing, but it is an aspiration. And I think that remaining like a log, that doesn't mean repressing what arises, repressing these desires to be seen, to be important, to get attention, to put other people down and put ourselves up. We don't want to repress that, but we do want to refrain from it. If we repress it, my experience is it just comes back bigger. If we're able to refrain it and find something else to do while still honoring that feeling, because these are natural human feelings, you know, we're just trying to have a good life and trying to get out of some suffering, and we're just like everybody else. But we can refrain. And the first ingredient that you all already do is this practice of meditation, of zazen. I think that's just so integral, because even in your zazen, you will see all these states arise. And you don't get up and go running out the door and or yell at somebody. You refrain. You sit. You watch it pass away. So that's, you're developing that awareness, and I think that that's the first and probably the most important ingredient, is just being aware of those desires and those impulses. And then there's it's also part of zazen, but also in your life, to just stay. That's what Pema Chodron says is the pith instruction in meditation, is stay. Just stay. Don't go wandering off in your mind. Don't go running off in your life. Just to stay with whatever is arising and not acting on it. So anger, for example, is perfectly fine. It's actually one of the most important emotions we have. If we stay with it, if we act on it, all kinds of trouble. Same with jealousy, same with even, you know, great joyfulness, you know, to suddenly erupt in the... I remember once asking my teacher, well, you know, it seems to be okay. I noticed that it's a shame sometimes people are going through a lot and they cry. What if I feel like laughing? She said, I wouldn't. Anyway, so staying. Knowing ourselves is really important, you know, is... Dogen says, to study the way is to study the self. That this is what we have to know. We have to know what triggers us and what hooks us. We have to forgive ourselves when we do get hooked, when we find ourselves acting on things, when we find ourselves gossiping, is that we come back and we forgive ourselves and go on. So it's something about seeing the hook, but not taking it. Knowing what our triggers are, knowing ourselves, but not acting on it. And this is a way of I think it's a process that happens, that we see the hook sometimes after we've already taken it, and after some practice with it, one day we'll see the hook as we're taking it, and maybe we won't bite down on it so hard, so we won't, you know, like the fish, we won't get it stuck in our lip, we'll just kind of release it. And then someday the day comes when we see it as it's coming, and we don't take it. And then finally we just, it doesn't bother us, it's not a hook anymore. I don't know if you know the autobiography of my life in 5 chapters. Is that trying to know? I lost my piece of paper. Here it is. But this is exactly that. It's called Autobiography in 5 Short Chapters. There's a hole in my sidewalk. Chapter 1. I walk down the street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I'm lost. I'm helpless. It isn't my fault. It takes forever to find a way out. Chapter 2. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. That's depression or denial. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place. It isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. Chapter 3. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it there. I still fall. It's a habit, but my eyes are open and I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out immediately. Chapter 4. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. Chapter 5. I walk down another street. So I think that's practicing with, that's learning to remain like a log, is to finally go a different way. It's what we call in the old Pali scriptures, I think there's a description of the non-arising of the destructive emotion. It's really quite amazing to be in a place to see, that used to really get me, and it didn't even come up. Didn't even come up this time. So this refraining, this is the third noble truth, right? It's the ending of suffering. Actually, suffering doesn't really end. I think that I've read somewhere that the translation of the word for in Pali is it's like the banking of a fire. So we don't put the fire out. Our suffering is never really completely gone, but we're able to bank it up and contain it. We're able to be with it. It's also the first, as I say, the first of the pure precepts. It's, you know, refraining from evil. It's the practice of patience and forbearance, which is one of the paramitas. And it also involves the Brahma Vihara, the heavenly abode of equanimity. So Shantideva, at the end of this treatise, he, in the chapter that's called Wisdom, when you finally practice compassion and you're finally there, he says, he gives this dedication. Oh, I'm sorry, it's not in the Wisdom chapter. It's in the dedication chapter, which is why I can't find it. And this is somewhat like the Bodhisattva vows. This is, I think, the backbone of the Bodhisattva vows. He says, and now, as long as space endures, as long as there are beings to be found, may I continue likewise to remain, to drive away the sorrows of the world. So that, as I say, that's saving all beings. And we do it by raising up our mind consciousness, by raising up the flower, just as Manjushri did. Maybe Manjushri did do it for Shakyamuni, who raised up the flower for Mahakashyapa. Thank you for listening. And maybe I left a few minutes for questions.
Yes, very few.
Sorry.
I'm just going to make announcements.
Oh, I was just kind of curious about the end of the story where he gets off down off of his throne. Are people surprised that he...
Actually, I mean, and this is all mythology, what happens, it says, is that at the end he rises up into the heavens. And he goes. But then later he comes back and he's seen somewhere else in India. You know, this is mythology. But I think the part that rings true is that here was this guy who was a ne'er-do-well, and we never know. You know, there may be somebody in our Sangha who just sits there and just seems like a bump, really isn't doing anything, and is always tripping over things, and yet they're practicing very deeply. So we just don't know what's going in it. So that's the part of the story that I find actually resonates and seems very current, that there are people like that and they are sincere in their practice too.
Well, and he shook up their world.
He did shake up their world, yes. He did. Thank you for listening. And thank you for your practice. And thank you for your forbearance. I realize I made everybody bow four times. But, you know, when in doubt, bow.
Thank you for the break from the precepts.
Oh, it wasn't really a break.
Thanks for making me think I was.
Yes, delusions are exhaustible. Yeah. Why, are the precepts hard?
Oh my gosh, they're so hard.
Okay.
Thanks for reminding us this is a practice.
Yeah, right. And we don't have to get there and there's no performance. You know, there's
test at the end of the hour.
Yeah, no, it's not going to be a test. Yeah, no evaluation, just practice. That's the other thing I think about Shantideva, is that, you know, we may think that we're ne'er-do-well and we're not really doing anything and we're not going to get anywhere, but it's all the same practice. There is no where to get. It's just practice. Linda, do you want to make announcements?
Sure. Well, first I'd like to let people know that you have a sitting practice on Wednesday nights.
I do.
In Willow Glen.
I do.
And I don't know if you want to get specifics or...
I should have brought something, but I didn't. But we sit, I have an office in Willow Glen. Judy comes in, joins me sometimes, and Ellie comes sometimes, and you all are welcome anytime. And we sit from 6:30 to 7, and then I promise, a much shorter talk than the one I did tonight, and then we have a little discussion. It's just a small, informal group. Yes, and it's in Willow Glen. So if you'd like to come sometime, let me know. We meet almost every Wednesday, but it's important to let me know, because once in a while I'm not there. So we'll see you.
And the floating Zendo is going to load up Summit Road on Saturday for our one-day sit.
That's such a lovely image. Mm-hmm. You are rising. Like Shantideva, you're going to float on Saturday.
Yes, it's going to be very lovely. It's Connie's garden is going to be in bloom. It's kind of a lot of native plants. So. Oh. Very rustic environment with an outdoor kitchen. So we'll have a lunch there served. You don't need to worry about bringing lunch, but you could bring additions too. And on the email that I send out, I give my phone number in case you'd like to carpool. And also, I'm going to send it out again. It'll have directions. That's all I have.
I have.
You have an announcement.
I have a little announcement. So next Tuesday, I have open house at my school. So if somebody could open 717.
Yeah.
I can do it.
You have a key card?
I have a key card. Yeah.
Okay.
Great.
Someone can do that. Yeah. Okay, and then we close with a 1 minute sit in
the
battles.
Okay.